Welcome to the BFM Historical Society. This week, we talk to Gemma Gracewood, a young woman who through sheer perseverance and determination completely overhauled the BFM News and Editorial Department. Gemma shares with us some of her fonder memories of BFM. Welcome to the BFM Historical Society, Gemma Gracewood.
Thanks, Dubhead. Nice to see you.
Now, for the record, when did you first hear about BFM?
Ooh, I would have been a young teenager in South Auckland, and I would have heard about it in the mid-80s. I think when my older sister and my older brother started listening to it, when we were all still at high school, and it was a revelation to all of us. Although I wasn't an active listener at that time, I just kind of soaked up like a sponge the music that they were discovering by listening to B. First song I remember being aware of in relation to BFM. It's the first time I discovered this artist, who remains one of my favourite. You know, he's in my top five, and through BFM I got to interview him three times. And you know, I'm a lucky pig for doing that. It's Billy Bragg, and it's his first hit single in New England. Brother Greg and I both ended up on staff at BFM. It was inevitable, really. Came from Papatoetoe into the big bad city to study at AUT over the road, and ended up writing for Crackham, next door to BFM, for about 3 years, because the Crackham student newspaper office was where we are now, actually. Well, next door to where we are now. And so I was next door to B and kind of looking across the hallway at these amazing older, sexy, sophisticated looking women with their long brunette hair and their Zambezi clothes, and these really interesting kooky guys going up and down the hallway, thinking, oh, I'm such a nerd, I could never be a part of that cool crowd. And then I finished my degree and was pretty much on the dole trying to figure out what to do next, and my friend Rachel, who had been reading the news at B, said, you're not doing anything, come up and we need more newsreaders. I'm the only girl there at the moment, me and Maria, Maria Keenan. So I was like, yeah, thought about it for a couple of weeks, and then I eventually showed up. She said, look, just come in, I'll write the bulletin, you go and read it, if you like it, you know, you can carry on. The premises weren't unfamiliar to me, but the actual state of the culture was. Wandered in, helped Rachel write a bulletin, she handed it to me, I went and read it, it was Friday Drive, and I finished my bulletin, and Graham Hill burst through the studio door as soon as the light went off and said, who was that? Who was that just then? I want her on breakfast. quite an exciting way to get started, really.
Favourable response. So that was 1994.
Yeah, early 94. I was still looking for a job and I ended up getting one for $75 a week at Max TV. So I started reading the news on B and doing the news, music news for Max TV at around about the same time. So for the next few years, that was me, really. I remember going over to the sanctuary of Graham Hill's bedroom, which was his office and his off-site recording studio, and he had tape recorders pretty much all around the room set to record things like the BBC World Service and National Radio and BFM itself for moments when something amazing would be happening on Drive that he would want to save for the archives for later. And he had piles of cassette tapes and just piles of everything. And it made me really aware of just how much work he put into Breakfast and the fact that his off-the-hookness actually came from a place of deep research. Mm. It taught me a lot. In order to be onto it, you need to be onto it. I remember the morning that Judith Tizard, before she was in government, when she was just a, you know, lowly Labour MP in opposition, came in to be our Friday morning guest 1 week, and he played her the recording that he had scored off a guy of her mother drunk in down in Altair
yes.
Square, telling the kids that she was going to kick them in the head. And I was thinking, don't play it, don't play it, don't. He's going to play it. Oh, how's this going to go down? Uh-oh. But Judith, being Judith, just laughed, you know, dealt with it quite well. Yeah, but that's the kind of stuff he'd pull out. And I just remember thinking that was amazing. And it was such a great way to run a show. And he was very much anyone you want to talk to, just get them on the radio. Just get them on, just do it. Let's just do it. It's radio. Just do it. And he taught me a lot about the live, exciting nature of radio and the fact that you can just do it more than any other medium. I remember, you know, we thought we were stuck out on the fringes of the media and that sort of no one was listening, but they always were. I remember one morning, and I think it must have been Mikey rather than Graham, although I can't quite be sure, but Neil Finn had written a song for the All Blacks to take them, you know, to support them into their latest World Cup rugby, you know, trial. And he wanted it to be an anthem and he wanted people to sing it from, you know, the very top row of the stadium. And we were talking about how it was just a little bit lame. You know, it was no kind of why does love do this to me. It was no, we don't know how lucky we are. It was a lovely song. Is it Can You Hear Us? We'll never let go. Can you hear us? Anyway, so we were just sitting there chatting about it and the phone rings and, you know, being BFM, we took the call live to air.
And it's Neil.
Hi, guys, it's Neil. I just, no, carry on. I just wanted to weigh in on the conversation since it is me you're talking about. And it was a good reminder of who's listening at any one time. When I first arrived, we had a really small dedicated team and we didn't have as much news on the air as there is now, as there was subsequently. It was Matt Bostwick, Garth Bray One News, Rhea Keenan, me, Phil Ewer, maybe one or two other people popping in and out, but that was the core team. Mm. And so between us, we covered the week's news, really. It was a great team. We were all still studying or just getting into our careers, so we had all the time in the world for BFM. All the time in the world. We were all on campus. We had nothing else to do and we just sort of threw ourselves into it. And it was a great team, but we didn't have a lot of resources. That was the thing that I found hilarious. We had a weird little news wire, a news feed that we apparently paid for, although I'm not really sure we did. And I think it came from either Radio New Zealand or the Radio Network. And you'd press this little refresh. This is before the internet. Way before the internet, you'd press a little refresh button every 15 minutes and another three stories would pop up about, you know, road crashes and GDP or whatever. We had that, we had the Herald, and we had a weekly issue of Time magazine. And we would have to go through Time magazine to find interesting international stories or quirky stories. And as you rewrote them into your news bulletin, you had to put a cross through that story and the date and the time next to it so that when the next newsreader came in the next day, they didn't double up and grab the same story. It was completely ridiculous. But what it did do was make us look harder for our own news because there was stuff going on in our own backyard, on campus, around town, venues opening and closing, you know, stuff happening with bands, all that kind of stuff. The thing is, we realised that there were people listening for whom BFM was their only source of information. And then there were people listening, just getting Sky, because that was kind of relatively new, who were watching 1 and 3 News, who were reading the paper every day. And so we had to kind of cover off both of them. So for the people who only listened to BFM, we needed to make sure that they were hearing the kind of key national news stories of the day. But for the people who were aware of everything else going on, we needed to make sure there was a BFM slant on it and that there was something new. And it was always a battle, because as the news team got bigger, so people spent less time in the newsroom and talking to each other, the problem sort of became that they weren't looking hard enough for stories that were exclusive to us. And we had plenty of access to exclusives. And so it's something that I really tried to emphasise more and more as the team got bigger, was we have so much exclusive access to news in our own backyard. Mm. We need to get it. We can't just regurgitate what's in the Herald. We'd get press releases rolling off the fax machine, and I'd watch a little newbie newsreader grab it and walk into the studio and read the first 3 sentences. And I'm like, are you crazy? You might as well have just been paid to do that by that company. That's not what we do around here. And so teaching them to do things like, in a press release that we just received on the BFM fax machine, you know, Goodman Fielder Watty, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And so just kind of deconstructing the news and where it comes from and how it's created. We did a lot of work in our news team on that.
Gemma, I want to talk now about the girls' own show.
It was called The Women's Show. I just remember Frankie and a couple of other women were doing it and had been doing it for a long time, and were at the point where they needed a break, and they threw up the opportunity of doing it every second week. And I was a little, you know, baby feminist with an undercut at the time, thought that it would be a lark. And also, you know, most of my personal music collection at that time was probably made up of Indigo Girls and Look Blue Go Purple and what have you. So, and it was my first chance at having a show. I'd been doing the news up until then and was keen to start DJing. So that was a natural place for me to be able to start, because Run of Station, I felt, was a little bit further off for me. But I had a specialist area, which was women's music, women's issues, blah, blah, blah. So I jumped on board and brought my friends Libby Bird and Kate England along. We changed the name. We decided it was at that time when, you know, Around the Bend was becoming, or I don't know.
In the Pink, yeah, became, in the Pink around the
became
Bend.
Around, yeah, the Bend. Yeah, it was just kind of, it's the 90s, let's refresh the station. Same show, different name, same time slot, blah, blah, blah. And I think one of the things that's so special about BFM is the specialist shows. They're so, so, so important. And yeah, so we gave it a bit of a makeover, called it The Girls' Own Show, and started making hilarious promos along the lines of sort of, you know, hoity-toity girls finishing schools. But the content itself was, you know, the good old same old, same old. Although maybe a little bit less of the Greyland lesbian and a little bit more of the, I mean, this was L7 time. And Yvette, I cannot go past Yvette as Girls on Show host as well. She was, we did it together for a long time, and she, you know, she introduced me to the shit list, she, you know, L7, all that kind of stuff. It was the early days of the Riot Girl movement. It was being ignored on the BFM main playlist, and it shouldn't have been, but it was. And we were the place that would bring that kind of music to light. We had women coming in talking about being strung up by meat hooks from their skin as a, you know, as a sexual outlet. We had live tattooing going on in the studio. We had live sex toy reviewing going on in the studio. And then we had the brilliant, one of my last shows was the brilliant legendary piss take interview with a comedian who did the best impersonation of Pauline Hanson, the Aussie politician that I've ever heard. And we just, you know, so we ripped it up. The point where I ducked out of the Girls' Own Show, I'd run into this girl who was, I can't even remember her name, but she was a little K-Road upstart who was, you know, about 10 years younger than me, and she had this massive collection of really interesting Riot Girl music on vinyl that I'd never even heard before. So I invited her up on the show to basically introduce the listeners to some of this new stuff. And I was like, wow, where did you find all this? And she just kind of looked at me like I was crazy and went, I search for it. She was singularly unimpressed. And then she wrote in her next little photocopied zine that she put out this review of being on the show with me. And she slammed me. She was like, I don't even know why she's hosting that show. She has no idea what's going on in women's music these days. She doesn't have a single clue. She doesn't go. I never see her at any of the gigs of these bands. She wouldn't even know who the Coolies were. Rah, rah, rah. And she was absolutely right.
Wow.
I was, you know, slightly past it. Since we're talking about the Girls' Own Show and women in rock and roll, I have to say this was my first and continues to be my favourite girl band. Look Blue, Go Purple.
Obviously, at the time, in the 80s and the 90s, there was a need for BFM to have a women's show.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's changed?
Oh, good question. I was counting up the number of women that you've had on the BFM Historical Society compared to men, and the percentage is frankly outrageous. Dubhead. Given the number of women who have been involved in the station at every level, including on-air and managerial. I mean, for goodness sake, there really hasn't been a female breakfast host. You know, I think Charlotte is great. I think her slot is great. I think that's a sign of the times. But I still think that if it's a numbers game purely, then there is still a need. If it's a numbers game on playlist, if it's a numbers game on, but then, you know, but the whole music industry is a numbers game. It's fine for guys to bunk off and spend hours under the hood of a car or hours on the front step trying to work out a riff on a guitar. But for a woman to be alone like that for hours is very unusual. We are encouraged to socialise. We're encouraged to talk on the phone. We're encouraged to be out and about with our girlfriends and moving in packs. And if you're a lone girl who's, you know, who's excelling in an instrument, then you're the weird outsider at school. So we're socialized to be like that, absolutely. And I think that's, and we're socialized to organize other people's lives, which is why you find that a lot of station managers around here or sales managers will be women, but the DJs will be men. So you know, I totally know where all that comes from, and I don't kind of blame BFM as a whole, because BFM as a whole is responsible for enlightening a lot of people in our society about a lot of stuff. I got told the other day by a very, very dear person to my heart that he came to university as a kind of closed-minded Westie, but after years of sitting in the quad, being exposed to BFM whilst doing his master's, he emerged a completely different person with completely different views about the world. And I think that that is the greatest compliment that anyone can pay to BFM and its power in our society. But BFM's not perfect, so there's always going to be inequality even within somewhere as perfect as BFM, and the best thing that we could ever do is sort of fight the good fight. Do we still need the Girls' Own show? I don't know. Even when I left, there were questions about whether it would continue, and I thought, until 50% of the playlist and 50% of the DJs and 50% of the staff are female, I think we still need a Girls' Own show. And I'd probably stick to that, just more out of a sense of self-righteous head in the sandness than an actual need, because when you also look at the success stories that have come out of this place, like you know, even recently Jackie Brown, Noelle McCarthy, you know, it's obvious the talent's coming through and it's obvious the talent is being supported. But I don't think that was always the case. But having said that, look at Good Morning and look at Stephen Gray on Good Morning, mainstream television every single day, and he came through this place. He started off as a film reviewer, he got his own Wire, then he ended up reviewing films on Good Morning, and now he is a gay mainstream television show host broadcasting to, you know, housewives and people on the dole everywhere, and I just love that. So even though it's not necessarily here in the halls of BFM, we're getting them out there. Tanya Fretz decided to move on. She'd been doing the Monday Wire for a long time, and the opportunity came up and I grabbed it. Bill Curtin basically handed it to me. He was the program director at the time. And he said, Gemma, you're up. And I remember being absolutely shit scared, but totally excited about the possibilities of spending a good 2 hours on the radio interviewing all and sundry, you know, taking that sort of 5 minute news slot and stretching it out. The Wire, I think, is one of those areas where BFM really excels. There is a lot of talk radio around, and national radio has been doing it for years, but there's just something about having a good old Barney with someone about the latest issues and then being able to drop a track that makes this place different from anywhere else. Yeah.
Back then it was 10 till 12.
It was 10 till 12. I was there for the changeover. Yeah. I was outraged by the changeover. I felt that the changeover was pandering to a breakfast show host who didn't know how to wrap his show up on time. I felt like there was a real beautiful run-on between the kind of pop nature of breakfast, where you had, you know, maybe 5 to 8 minutes of interview time between songs and, you know, surf reports and all the special stuff. And then, bang, 10 a.m., the chance to really stretch out and really make a big show of expanding those thoughts and ideas. And then, boom, midday comes and it's music for the rest of the afternoon. It just felt like the natural order of things was being upset, that when our brains are the most awake and the most willing to receive information is when we should have been giving it, and then when everyone's ready to cruise through into the afternoon, that's when we should have just been giving them music. And not only that, but, you know, Graham had always been very good at wrapping up, you know, 5 to 10, final track on, here comes the Wire, whereas Mikey, you know, he started late, he finished late. And so The Wire would end up being an hour and a half show. I did protest against the move. But at the same time, Kim Hill was doing 9 to Noon on national radio, and she was very rock and roll, and a lot of our listeners were listening to her. So they'd listen to Mikey 3 to 10, and then they'd switch over to get the 2 hours of her features. And so, you know, in hindsight, it was the right decision. And it was great to be able to start at bang at midday with the news and off you go. And then finish the sort of between 1:30 and 2 were always the kind of softer features, like the magazine reviews and the film reviews and stuff. And it was perfectly paced. And I find it really interesting now that Breakfast is still where it is with who it is, and The Wire is still where it is. But now there's this lovely kind of bridge between the two with Charlotte's show. Yeah. Which is a bit more talking and a bit more of the artsy stuff, but a lot of really great music. I think it's a beautiful mix that kind of runs us all the way through the day. It's good. One of the really wonderful things about BFM is watching your friends form their first band and record their first album and bring it up and get it played on the radio. And one of my favourite bands at the time was when Jeffrey and Ed and the crazy guys from Bressa, Creed and Kate got together. And Palm Singing, I think I played it on every single show I ever did on BFM. I loved it that much. Me and Andrea Wilson, if we were on the air on the same day, we'd compete as to who got to play this song. It's Palm Singing. Interesting thing had been happening at B. Graham had moved on, and with him went all of those archiving and editorial skills that he had brought to BFM in the first place. And it felt like we were in danger of losing an aspect of BFM that was particularly special for this town. Towards the end of Graham's breakfast time, I was actually acting as an unpaid amateur producer, and he'd actually said to me, we'd had a meeting, and he'd said to me, look, I want you to start taking over. I want you to start booking guests, and I actually want you to start actively producing the show. You know, A, he was tired, and B, he was busy, and he just wanted some fresh ideas and fresh blood. So I was kind of doing the job anyway. And then on top of that was coordinating the newsreaders anyway. So I'd kind of created the job in effect. And then management at the time saw that this was a need and an opportunity. So they created the position and promptly gave it to someone else, which was probably...
Excellent. Who was that?
It was a really, really, really lovely guy called Andrew, who came from West Auckland, who hadn't done any sort of radio and editorial stuff in a while, had been a journalist but was working at the Waitakere City Council. It was an interesting time for me because I think it was probably my first great heartbreak involving this place, the first of many. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. The interview was extremely uncomfortable, The panel were three people who, you know, if I'd been older and wiser and had known better, I would have protested about who was on the panel for various personal reasons. And it was just deeply uncomfortable. And I was destined never to get the job the first time. And I was a woman scorned. And I was ready to just walk out of this place, to drop all of my shows, to drop everything I was doing and just bugger off. And I got a number of calls from a number of people, both on staff and on DJs, to say, we've heard what's happened. We think it's wrong, but don't leave. And it was interesting. I had a couple of really great conversations with people who'd had similar experiences but had stayed for the sake of the station and were ringing to say, BFM is bigger than the people who are running it right now. You need to hang around. I will forever be in their debt. Things didn't necessarily fall apart with Andrew. He was really respected and really well loved. 7 months later, he just turned around and he said, Gemma, I want you to be the first to know I'm quitting this job, and I'm highly recommending that they don't advertise the position, that they just give it to you. And that's what happened. Great. It was great to just be able to walk in on Monday and go, okay, this is how it's going to work.
Let's go.
Here's what we're going to do. And really exciting to have that job. And I'm really glad that I didn't walk away, you know, when I could have. And, you know, my main focus really was I saw that some wonderful things have been happening. You had to contextualise this for the kids of today. You'll remember this. This was a time, mid-90s, when the youth market had suddenly been discovered by the mainstream. So we had Max TV, and then those guys were branching out and starting Juice TV. We had all of the magazines. We had Planet and Pavement and Pulp, all that stuff going on. We had youth interest and youth music shows starting to appear on mainstream TV. And because of that, they were, you know, they had Newsnight, where you had the two kind of...
That's right. The two news mainstream, for teenagers.
Exactly, news for teenagers, where you had your two mainstream hosts and then Marcus Lush, of all people. So what I saw happening was that basically they were plundering our talent for their shows. And I saw an opportunity to train up, you know, to find this talent and train them up and make them good and strong and independent so that they could... function well in that environment. And that was my focus, really, was just getting people in and making them better. And I used to call up John Campbell at TV3 and go, John, what are you doing on Wednesday night? Do you want to come in for a news and editorial training session? And we had all these amazing free training sessions with the best of the best in the mainstream industry coming in and looking after our little guys. And, you know, that was a time when I took Jackie Brown off Talkback and put her on The Wire, when we were turning Green Dean into the award-winning, you know, sustainability and environmental reporter that he is now. And he ended up on national radio, and just basically getting these people and teaching them discipline and also, you know, to trust their own instincts and their own minds and getting them out there again. But it made for really interesting politics in the news team. But the problem of balancing those who had more time and were more keen but didn't really sound that great on the radio versus those who could swan in and do one bulletin and be amazing, which I guess is kind of how I started, like your newsboys kind of thing. And I remember I had at one point a gaggle of newsgirls, about eight of them, who'd all been working really hard, and then one walked in and she was amazing, and I put her straight on Breakfast. And all of the others rose up and went, Gemma, how could you do that? It was... that slot was for one of us. We deserve it. We've been working harder. And I was like, yeah, but you know what? If I learnt one thing from Bill Curtin and Graham Hill, it's that you don't reward crapness. on the radio. And it's so difficult because they're volunteers as well. And that's the biggest political hurdle you have to kind of jump in this place is they're volunteers, they're doing it for nothing. But actually they're not doing it for nothing because look at where they are now. And, look at where you can end up if you excel on BFM. People are listening. Mm.
You really made it work. You turned news and editorial around. You
know? Yeah, I mean, I think my satisfaction comes from running into people now who say to me, oh, you were a bitch and I hated you, but in hindsight, you taught me everything I needed to know and look at where I am now. Mm. And I've had that a lot. And, you know, if that's what I had to be and that's what I had to, you know, go through. It is not a popularity game. You do want people to like you, but if they don't, well, you know, what can you do? You just actually want... For me, the greatest motivation was that I wanted BFM to sound as good as it could possibly sound. And if that meant walking over some, you know, 19-year-old's poor little broken-hearted ego, then that's what it meant. And it's really hard to do that, and someone has to. Pity whoever it is now. Because I know what it's like to be hated universally by, you know, teenagers. Mikey was many wonderful Mikey things, but Mikey was not Graham in the sense of the editorial research that Graham would do and the, you know, the archives that he had. Mikey came along with much more sort of off-the-cuff gung-ho gusto, but he wasn't going to sit at home at night and ring people and line up interviews. It was identified really quickly by Adam, the station manager at the time, that Mikey was going to need a producer and that they should throw some money at that. And because I was already kind of doing the job, it was obvious that it should be me. And I really did not have any problem with getting up that early, and it was probably a good thing that I did because it was a rare day when Mikey was in before 7. But the one thing I wouldn't do, I did it once and I never made that mistake again, was actually get on the air when he wasn't in yet. We'd get in, we'd make sure the news happened, we'd make sure the ads happened, we'd make sure the playlist happened, but we wouldn't actually talk. And there was one morning where he was just running way too late and someone had to get on and say something, and man, did I get bollocksed for it. And I wasn't even doing it out of ego, I was doing it out of the need to let all those people on the motorway know that it was 5 to 8 and that Mikey would be along soon. Oh, that was quite hilarious. A few times we did try doing cell phone crosses where we'd talk to Mikey as he was coming over the Auckland Harbour Bridge. That was quite good until it got a bit too expensive making all those mobile calls because, you know, cell phones have never been cheap in this country. It was a brand new show. We needed brand new features. We needed brand new everything. And so we just kind of set it up from scratch. And we do some very, very silly little features like When I Grow Up, I Want to Be. We had a list in the newsroom of things that people wanted to be, like someone who saves the whales or a ladies' man. And we'd just go around finding these people and who'd tell their interesting stories. Natural Ange came at that time. I mean, she's built a career out of her. She was already a naturopath, but, you know, out of her regular thing, she's got that column in the Sunday magazine. And it was my job to go around and, you know, meet all the naturopaths in town who could possibly be great on the radio. Narrowed it down to 2, Natural Nikki and Natural Ange, and they kind of did week about for a while, but Ange was, she was always going to be the star. So that was kind of what I did. I just cruised around town finding interesting people to make the show. Oh, which reminds me of one of my other favourite features on Mikey's Breakfast. It was when we discovered that Li Ming, our newsreader, could play violin like a virtuoso. And not only that, but she could play violin along to anything, any challenge we set her. And so we would make her go away and learn the most ridiculous songs on violin and then come in and play her violin at a squealing volume over the top. And my favourite cover that she ever did was Jesus Christ Pose. It was magnificent, and I wish I still had a recording of that. It was exciting times. Some amazing things would happen. One of my favourite breakfast moments was when we got a call from our mate in the music industry to say, so Colin from Radiohead is in town. He's on Waiheke Island visiting his sister who's got a goat farm. He's been listening to BFM and he really likes it, and he was wondering if he could come in and be interviewed on breakfast. What? Are you serious? Colin from Radiohead called us to ask if he could come in on breakfast just before OK Computer was about to be released. And, you know, obviously that's when Radiohead went completely supersonic. Mm. They headlined Glastonbury that year and it was pretty much all over for them in terms of being able to walk down the street. And Colin from Radiohead came in and spent the whole morning with us just chatting in between songs and just shooting the shit, really, and playing us a couple of tracks from the new album. Mm. That would never happen now. Never, ever, ever, ever. So that was pretty special. That was a good one. It is time for another song, and I reckon it needs to be The Breeders, Cannonball. Just, you know, another one for the girls. Love it. Love it to bits. One of the things I've always loved is a bit of a party. One of the things that I did in the years that I was at BFM was institute the annual Christmas party, as in make it more than just a few drinks in a bar or a few drinks in reception and everyone writing on the walls and, you know, shagging each other and going home in a really bad state. I was a bit more interested in making a Christmas party that was kind of more in keeping with our culture. And I remember one year, before the King's Arms was known as a music venue, I went down with one of the sales ladies to have a chat with them and basically say, can we do our Christmas party here? Can you give us a bar tab and we'll just tell everyone about you and make everyone come? The 88-year-old owner of the King's Arms, whose fingers were dripping in diamond rings, said, yeah, sure, that sounds like a bunch of fun. So we had a completely ridiculous Christmas party that year in which BFM formed a band called Neon Lines, Neon LYNZ, which played only covers of New Zealand songs. That was pretty hilarious. And after that, you know, all the bands wanted to play at the King's Arms, and it kind of became a place where people went. And you know, I was quite proud of that, because part of what BFM does is find the new thing that's going on and promote it. And it's important for Auckland that, you know, it still has that role. The next year we went to Point Erin Pools and had a ridiculous pool party with a dance off in the pool that I think Joel Tobeck won, yeah, over Hugh Sunday, who tried to wrestle the prize off him. And we all just got a bit boozed and dressed up in 80s clothes. And so we were starting to sort of build up this culture of really good parties and celebrations. And then the 30th birthday came along and the finger was pointed at me to organise it. So we figured out that the official birthday of BFM was May. So every single day there was something to celebrate BFM's 30th birthday, whether it was a giveaway or a show or whatever was happening. But the two, at the beginning of the month and the end of the month, we had two big special celebrations. And at the beginning of the month, we did a live breakfast show down in the Maidman Theatre. One of my fondest memories of BFM. So we moved the whole studio down there. We had me and Newsboy doing news live as it happened. With a live audience, it meant that there was a lot of laughter. It was good fun. And we had some of the old guys who set up BFM come in. But my favourite thing about the whole show was we had live ads. Live ads. We had Bob Scott, Joel Tobeck, a few others. We had a gravel tray with shoes stuck to sticks that were walking along in the gravel. They had a cardboard tube, which was the voice of God telling you that you must go to the university bookshop or whatever it was. It was silly. It was great fun. And it was really exciting to do it in front of a live audience. And then at the other end of the month, we had a massive gig at the power station in which I personally navigated the politics of the Hallelujah Picassos one by one and convinced them to reform for this occasion. And then I convinced Slave and Otis to come out of retirement and pull off their MC OJ and the Rhythm Slave stuff. I somehow convinced Chris Knox to put on a Marilyn Monroe dress and wig and sing Happy Birthday to BFM in that get up. And then my favourite thing of all was I asked Head Like a Hole if they would headline. They were dicks, man. They beat around the bush. They asked for far too much money. They hummed and hard. They were like, oh, we want this much, we want that much. And I was like, well, you know what? I'm just going to ask my favourite band of the moment, which was UMI, who, you know, are an Australian band. Like, I think I might just ask them. So I rang the record company and said, do we have a shit show in hell of being able to convince UMI to come over? And they went, yeah, they'll do it for the money that you were offering Head Like a Hole, but that Head Like a Hole were asking twice as much for. And I got my mum to cater the event and she put on oysters because it was the Pearl anniversary. Yep. And I remember UMI walking into the green room and going, there are fresh oysters on our rider. What kind of place is this? We love it. We invited Helen Clark along to give the speech at the opening drinks.
That's right.
Because it was an election year. We knew very much what we were doing and she knew what she was doing. So she was there with bells on and Peter came with her, which I thought was really lovely. And we had a balloon drop. We were like, let's go full cheese. And we blew up all these balloons, put them in a net, had a balloon drop in the middle of the gig. It was great. This is from that same era. It was always fun, speaking of neon lines and, you know, all the internal BFM bands. It was always fun when a BFM band would pop up. And, you know, I was never really a groupie. You can't be when you're getting the chance to interview people like Katie Lang and Colin from Radiohead. But the only band I was ever a true groupie of was a very, very local band who went nowhere fast. But I loved them very, very much. And Lord knows why, but it's Pash.
Trying to tell me this for so long. You put it all into my hands, but all of it's gone. You know I meant it when I said it. You and me. No one said it's easy, but it's harder than I dreamed. We'll be right back.
They've been taken unceremoniously off breakfast producing because, as someone described it very politely, me and Mikey working together was like a marriage between two people who didn't really want to be married to each other but had been forced into it. We worked really hard, but we were so young. And actually, one of the things that I remind myself of now, in order not to feel extraordinarily bitter about some of the more revolting things that happened in my time at BFM, is that we were so young and that even management were young. You know, I was 25 and managing a team of volunteers with no management experience. And whoever was managing me, it was probably only their first or second, you know, management job. So they would have had no management experience. And as wonderful and crazy as that was, also created deep personnel problems between people. I was never really bullied beyond primary school until I got to BFM. And I had truly awful experiences that I would rather forget, but have helped me to form a relatively thick skin in all of my other jobs. I'd done all I could. I'd, you know, brought all those new people into breakfast, and Mikey had won his award for best new broadcaster, and it was, you know, it was time for us to be separated. And I was enjoying news and editorial, but I kind of like, I'd helped instigate the BFM, at that year it was the BFM Music Awards, and, you know, hosted them and put that band together when Mikey did that great lounge cover of Straightjacket Fits, She Speeds. Brilliant, yeah. Complete with Hot Gossip Dancers. Very proud of that moment. This last song is representative of my personal coming into the world of better music and coming into the BFM world. I saw the Jean-Paul Sartre Experience at the Glue Pot in, I think, around 92, 93. And for me, it was, I know it doesn't sound that very, very long ago, but to older listeners, but for me, it was a revelation. It was the first time that I really felt that there was a part of Auckland that I belonged to, just standing in that venue with that crowd listening to that music. This was the song that kind of did it for me, really. It's Elemental.
have been listening to the BFM Historical Society, a weekly documentary series made to commemorate BFM's 40th anniversary. The Historical Society is broadcast every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. and is available from BFM's website later on in the week as a podcast. The BFM Historical Society is produced by Dubhead at BFM.